first 4 or 5 years, you and I, I'd get off work and you and me were like tied at the hip.
Yeah.
You know, and then family member married somebody that was selling cocaine, and we started selling cocaine and became our, you know, made a lot of money first and became our own best customer, and started ignoring my kids, which is an amend I've made to Christian about how I remember standing on the dresser drawing a line, seeing my son in the hallway, you know, when he's 8 or 9, and I knew I should be there, but I was not.
Welcome to the Most High Show, a show about recovery, spirituality, and all that. Produced, posted, and hosted by people in recovery who have strength and hope and want to share it with you. If you or someone you love is suffering, we want you to know you are not alone. This is the Most High Show.
God, thank you for the opportunity to gather. Thank you for this platform, and we offer this time to your care and control. Amen. We are recording now. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, humans of the world and everything in between, welcome to the Most High Show, made by and for people in recovery. A show about recovery, spirituality, and being human. Our mission is to provide impactful, community-driven media that informs, empowers, and inspires positive change. Real people, real stories, real life. This is the Most High Show. Okay, so today we have a special, special episode. This being on the, is it on the heels? No, that would be after.
Mm-hmm.
It's on the toes?
Yeah, it's on the fingertips.
On the eve of Father's Day.
It's almost on the eve. When you talk into the mic, you have to talk into the mic, so you'll need to, yeah, there you go. And you can move it a little bit, or you can scoot your chair in to get more comfortable. So, yeah, because it's Father's Day weekend,
mm-hmm.
we're taking a whole weekend, and we're going to be talking about Father's Day. We're not talking about Father's Day. We're talking about the programming we inherit from our fathers, intended or not, and how do we break generational curses.
Mm.
Yeah, real light stuff on a Friday night.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Yeah. And with us today is Sarah with an H.
The H stands for father.
Yep. Hellion. And we have an in-studio audience. Caleb's doing quality control. Jason's on the ones and twos. And our special guest is my dad, a.k.a. Eric Jansen. So, ladies and gentlemen, welcome Eric to the Most High Show. That was a rough intro. I've been off a few weeks.
Yeah, okay. Welcome back, by the way.
Thank you.
We missed
you. Thank you. And it's nice that you guys hold it down and I'm able to, like, have a Friday every once in a while. It's pretty cool. Yeah. You guys have pulled off a couple of really good episodes.
Thanks. I like to pretend I'm you.
Oh, do you?
Yeah. I'm like, wow, this feels really nice to be secure and good at my job.
Oh. Yeah, you guys had the Gar lady. What was her name?
Why would you put me on the spot like that? You know my memory is terrible.
I'm waiting for one of the interns to say the name.
Candace.
Wilkerson. And then you had a very meaningful episode with your friend, Josie.
Yeah, with Josie, and she shared her story.
Yeah. We hadn't done a story in a while.
Yeah, we hadn't.
So tonight, we're going to hear a little bit about my dad's story, and we're going to talk about some of these unconscious programmings that we all receive. And so why don't you tell us a little bit about you, Eric, when you were born, where'd you grow up, kind of just like a short kind of version.
Okay. I was born in Canada and came to the United States when I was 5, 1956, and grew up in Santa Monica, and then the San Fernando Valley when that opened up. That's where I graduated high school.
So L.A. area.
Yeah.
All right.
Thank you for translating the geography. I'm like, where's that?
Well, it was in the 50s and the 60s.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what were the values that you were taught when you were young in your household?
Oh, when I was young? We were taught to respect mom. Dad you respected because he was the guy with the belt. So, but the main thing was respect Mom. And don't lie and, you know, basically just be a good person. Mom took us to church. So we got, you know, the churchy idea of being good. But, you know, we pretty much had to toe the line in my house.
Yeah. Okay. So you had to toe the line. What did that mean?
That meant that if you did something that pissed off Dad, you'd get the belt. And my dad drank heavily and was verbally abusive. Not really physically. He wasn't very big. But he was, well, when he was chasing with the belt, you know the dance?
No.
Where he's got you by one hand and you're running around trying to stay ahead of the belt?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. That was back. That was a different generation. You could hit your kids then.
Yeah.
So.
Okay. What do you think that did, like, you know, now you're looking back and you're...
Well, my brother and my sister and I all suffered from, in various ways, from feeling not being good enough because we could never really please Dad. So, yeah, my brother got real quiet and insecure, and my sister, you know, she got married when she was 18, and that marriage ended, she married somebody else, and just she just stayed in relationships, wasn't close to the family. And I ended up actually being more like my dad than my brother and my sister, which is odd because I'm the adopted child.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's kind of a big deal. So you didn't know you were adopted until...
I knew I was adopted when I was a kid, my parents told me. I didn't find out who from until I was 28, till after you came along.
Oh.
Yeah, and then I found out that my birth mother was my mom's sister, so I was raised by my aunt, but she got mom billing because... She put up with me for all those years.
Yeah, yeah. So at 28, you hear this. Does it change?
No, it actually, I basically just told my parents that, you know, I'm good. I'm happy. I stopped asking who my parents were years ago because I had a good family. Because as I got older, my dad got a handle on his drinking. Actually, he had a couple of heart attacks. That stopped him from drinking. And we started to have a better relationship.
Yeah. All right. Now, there's a area of your life, a time, where you leave L.A. to live in the desert and mine gold. Yeah. So tell us a little about...
Okay, I'm going to tell you how that started. That started with my best friend in high school. And him and I, when we got high, we'd get a gallon of Red Mountain wine and a bag of pot and do the whole thing in one weekend. Just, it was how far can you get? Well, his dad was an archaeologist, and he took us out to the desert and introduced me to his friend Walt, who was a Depression-era miner that was living 40 miles from the nearest town, 8 miles off the paved highway. So anyway, I met Walt and had gone out there a number of times with my best friend after we got driver's licenses, and it turns out that best friend died 2 weeks before I graduated high school. So, and that hit me pretty hard. And I was already a partier, so I kind of went crazy with the LSD. I was turned into an escape artist.
Yeah.
I just got high to escape. I was working at a sandal shop in Calabasas, making leather belts and handbags and, you know, smoking all day long and taking LSD 5-6 times a week. And it got really hard on my health. I weighed nothing. And for some reason, I decided to pack my duffel bag. And back then, a duffel bag came from somebody in the Army, but I wasn't in the Army, but everybody used duffel bags instead of suitcases. Mm-hmm. And I hitchhiked to Last Chance. And I thought I'd spend a couple months.
Could you imagine hitchhiking today?
You see, as a woman, I don't think hitchhiking was ever good for us at any point in history.
It was in the 60s.
I don't know. That's when serial killers were very active. Yeah. We didn't have DNA testing yet.
Anyway, this I hitchhiked out there, and I thought it'd spend 2 months. I was there for 2.5 years. So.
And you would actually mine or pan for gold?
We would. It was placer ground, which is sand and gravel. And what you'd do is you had to figure out where the bedrock was, or you'd follow the bedrock down, because gold being the heaviest of all the stuff that's out in the desert, when the desert was fluid, which is, I mean, their last chances used to be a lake or an ocean bottom, you know, millennia ago. So the gold would always go to the bottom, to the bedrock, to the lowest point. So you'd follow the bedrock down. When you got close to it, then you started saving what you were digging out, and you'd run that through a dry washer, which agitated it and got most of the dirt out, and then you'd pan out the last of black sand and the gold.
Yeah.
And we made about $90 a month between the two of us, because it was an ounce, it was $90, and some months we didn't get any gold, and some months we'd get 2 or 3 ounces. So it averaged $90 an ounce.
Yeah.
He sold it to a dentist.
Oh, who was making crowns or something?
Who was selling it to the guy that makes the crowns and stuff, because he had to add certain things to make it hard enough to make the teeth out of it.
Yeah. And this was 1971?
1970.
Okay, so the dollar conversion, $90 in 1971 would be $715 today.
Yeah.
So still not enough every month. But.
Well, it was enough to live on because we didn't have running water or electricity. We didn't have rent. We got our water from a spring 2 miles away. We'd throw the barrels in the pan wagon and drive it over to the spring and fill up the barrels, the stainless steel barrels. Rainwater we collected for washing dishes and taking showers and stuff.
Oh, so were you like off grid?
We were 8 miles off the road, 40 miles from the nearest town.
And no electronic. Wow.
No.
Huh. So $700. That's a lot of weed, wine, and food.
It was groceries. And for me, it got me away from the road I was going and the Hollywood and the drugs and the people I was hanging out with. And I did end up in my time there going home every once in a while, and then I'd get a little bag of pot, but I got real miserly with it where I'd take 2 hits a night. But I got out of my heavy, heavy drug use. Mm. So it was really good for me. And there was something else that happened because I was a young kid. I was lost. My best friend had died. I grew up in a house where I was never good enough, so I was kind of not good enough. Mm. And my relationship with Walt at the time was more of a grandfather figure. And in the time I was there, I gained his respect, which changed how I looked at me. So,
yeah.
So you had someone you respected and now respected you in return.
Yeah.
That's a powerful feeling.
Yeah, that was God sent is what it was. Looking back on it, why I moved out there, I think it was God going, okay, you need to be somewhere else. Let's go out here.
Yeah.
You know,
well,
who knew why I went out there. Anyway, it was fun. And it's something that not very many people do. I'd wake up. I'd sleep outside all summer long.
Yeah, in the desert.
In the night, it'd be 72 degrees, 73 degrees. You sleep outside without a blanket. You woke up in the morning when the sun came over the hill and the flies started bugging you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What a adventure.
And you remember the stars.
Yeah, I remember, you know, as a kid, we'd go out there. And hang out. And
I'd take you up on the mesa to sleep.
Yeah.
And we'd see the universe.
Yeah.
That was incredible.
Yeah, because you're so far away from any city, like
light. There's no light pollution.
And it was at 3,000 foot elevation.
Make sure you stay on the mic so we can hear you. So it was a pretty sky.
Wow.
You could see all the colors.
You'd wake up in the middle of the night and the Milky Way would be running across the sky.
See, I love the city, right? Like, I love a good skyline. I love being here. But the one thing that I hate is that when I look up in the sky, I see half of a glimmer of one star, you know? Yeah. And then even if you go like an hour north, it's like, oh, there's a couple more, but there's still. That sounds like a view I need to make happen.
So anyway, that was a real pivotal point in my life.
So, yeah, I mean, talking about father figures, right? So Walt seemed to take on kind of a father figure.
Grandfather figure to start with. And we became very close. He was the best man at my wedding. So we became equals, compatriots. We were just good friends.
Yeah.
You know, and even after I left, you'd go to Last Chance with us at least once or twice a month.
Yeah.
We were always going out there.
Yeah.
It was about an hour, 20-minute drive.
Yeah.
So this place stayed an integral part of your life.
Until he passed away, and his grandkids are running it now. It's on the historical registry as one of the last Depression-era mining camps.
Wow.
So.
That's really cool.
Yeah, I'm trying to make a
Bicklecamp.org.
Bicklecamp.org. Yeah.
Okay.
So we kind of live in these ways. And, you know, we in recovery, we talk about, like, the software we receive. And everyone receives software from our parents or whoever raises us. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, me and Sarah were talking about the show coming up and saying how it kind of doesn't really, like, if you're worried that you've messed your kids up, don't worry, because you have, right? Like, even parents who seem to seemingly have it all together, you know, there's still unintentional software that gets deposited. I'm sure there are healthy environments and kids grow up more healthy. But what were some of the things that you think you unintentionally received, like what I would call them are thinking patterns that took you time to unwind and be free of yourself, that you picked up from your father, from your the way you grew up?
I don't know if I picked up things that I let go of. I got things from my dad that were surprises to me that I noticed years later on that I had a really good work ethic, because my dad worked all the time. Had a really good work ethic. I always tried to do whatever I did as perfect as I could make it, because that was how I was raised. It had to be perfect.
Yeah.
You know, so, but both of those served me really well when it came time to have a family.
Yeah.
Yeah. So now I did get the verbal abusive part when I drank. I was not a happy drunk.
Right.
And my tongue was very sharp, just like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So.
Yeah. What about for you, Sarah? Like you, and I know you have a good relationship with your father now.
Yeah.
You know, but what were some of the unintended things that you feel like you picked up on from your...
Oh, man. Well, since my dad and I do have a good relationship now, we can joke about it, but... I tell him to his face that I got all of his worst traits, but on max. Because my dad was kind of similar, where he was heading down a bad way as a teenager and had a moment of clarity and was like, I gotta fix my shit, get out of this. And so he pivoted. Whereas I took, like, again, like, not really knowing this about my dad, then, like, fell really hard into drug addiction and did drugs he never did. Like, he was too scared to do, and took drinking way farther than he ever did. And so it's like whatever trait he had, I just full send.
Yeah.
And so then the same thing with a lot of, like, emotional behaviors that I have, you know, I picked up from him, like, and things that sobriety have helped calm down. But, you know, like, being, like, emotionally explosive and, you know, just, like, the reactivity, just, you know, you got to be quick, be on your feet, because, you know, it's just survival.
Yeah, well, I think, like, you know, when we talk about, you know, my grandfather, your dad, I think you said he was the only non-college graduate at
He worked for Space Technology Laboratories. He was the only senior product engineer who did not have a college degree. My dad was self-taught, left home when he was 14, worked as a stevedore on the St. Lawrence River in Montreal, Toronto area.
Yeah.
And a highly super intelligent guy.
Mm-hmm.
I got a lot of that from him, even though he wasn't my dad. I was raised in that environment, and you got a lot of it from me.
Yeah.
It's that, give us a problem, and 15 minutes, we'll figure it out. And
yeah.
It was just, it's always been there for me, and it's always been there for you.
Yeah. Well, my son's here, and he has that ability also.
Oh, yeah.
You know, we were trying to push him into engineering, because he's got that mind to be able to
You see everything.
Figure things out.
Yeah. And you can fix anything that you can get a mental picture of in your head.
That's so, my mom's the one that carries that trait. I did not get that from her, but my brothers did.
So it's so, like, we're picking up on something that's, like, passed on, you know. And if we were to go and ask, somehow magically be able to ask my grandfather what his father was like, what we would probably see that this is a trait that gets kind of passed on.
My dad's dad was a single father, and he was a communist, and he was meaner and shit, which is why my dad left at 14.
Yeah, there's a thing called a crow's funeral.
I've not.
Oh, good. So I haven't talked about that crow's funeral?
No. Well, I mean, if you have, I wasn't paying attention.
So my cousin, Skyler, lives in Santa Barbara. He was telling me about he had this crow that would fly into the balcony of his house and eat the cat's food and then pester the cat, try to get the cat. So he started researching, well, how do you get rid of a crow? So he bought this fake dead crow, and he put it on the roof of his house. And one day, he goes outside, and there is like 100 crows flying around, all squawking. And so he's like, what the hell? Like, this is like not getting better, right? But what it is what crows will do, and I think Harvard did a study on this too. So what crows will do is when they see a dead crow, they will all gather together. And it's a way for them to somehow, genetically, they pass this down. So birds that have never seen where that dead crow, those birds will know not to go there. Yeah. So no crow will go there again. Somehow,
crows are super smart.
Right.
Super smart.
But they're not communicating how we do, like with story, as we're doing today, right? You're sharing stories, so this leaves an imprint. But there's something that these crows are doing that is passing it down genetically.
Yeah, they're training behavior.
Yeah, in a very interesting way.
It's like, how does a salmon find the creek that it was born in 4 or 5 years after being in the ocean?
Oh, yeah, right. I don't know. Google? Fish Google?
Fish Google?
Yeah.
I think regular Google covers fish.
Yeah. And so in our latest documentary, we talked about ACEs, adverse childhood experiences, and how adverse childhood experiences, if you have four or more ACEs, which could be, you know, abuse, physical abuse, verbal abuse, growing up in an unsafe environment, an environment that's not stable, that they can directly link these adverse childhood experiences to someone getting cancer, having diabetes, having heart disease. Mm-hmm. And so there's something that's in humans that's just like this crow's funeral that's being passed on genetically, right? Whether it's nature or nurture or a combination of the two of them, right? Like your father wasn't your biological father, but he nurtured you in a way that he was nurtured, that kind of like gets wired in.
Yeah.
And we think of it like as a moral dilemma, right? Mm-hmm. And it's really not. It's kind of a biological, it's a feature of human existence to pass these things on.
Yeah, you become like your pack.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So it's not a good or bad thing, but it's something that we should acknowledge exists. Like I really wish we taught ACEs in high school, you know, for kids to learn so that they could know the things that you can do to combat these things that you might already have a natural propensity towards.
It's ironic because the alternative school in my district was ACE Academy.
Oh.
So I'm sure the ACE kids did have ACEs.
Yes, right. But they're more like ACEs. We're ACEs.
No, this was right before you drop out of school, you go to ACE.
It was a hopeful title for the school.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, these patterns, they get passed on. I think we can do our best, right? And we talk a lot about here at Most High breaking generational curses, you know, which is something that I feel like, you know, I've been able to do, right, in a lot of ways. When I look at my children and the relationship I have with my wife today and a stable family and upbringing that's helping them to transition from childhood, adolescence into adulthood, right? Which, you know, in a lot of ways I didn't have, right?
Yeah.
Like those periods of my life, there was a lot of other things going on, right? And so I didn't really get to have that, but I can see us today, all of us, you included, right? Like because you're very involved in the kids' lives and all of your grandkids' lives.
Yeah.
And so I think all of us together as a tribe have made conscious decisions to rewire
better people.
Yeah.
Better family members.
Yeah.
When you were born, because I was an adopted child, and remember I didn't know who from at that time, you were the first person on this planet that I was blood related to. that's how I saw your birth.
Mm.
Okay, so in the first 4 or 5 years, you and I'd get off work, and you and me were, like, tied at the hip.
Yeah.
You know, and then family member married somebody that was selling cocaine, and we started selling cocaine and became our, you know, made a lot of money first and became our own best customer, and started ignoring my kids, which is an amend I've made to Christian about how I remember standing on the dresser drawing a line, seeing my son in the hallway, you know, and he's 8 or 9, and I knew I should be there, but I was not.
Mm.
So.
Yeah. And I have those same memories with my kids.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And I think, like, the key thing is that, you know, what Dr. Zach says about the neuroplasticity of the brain, mm-hmm. what we know, those of us who are in recovery, like, who live this life, that these things can be remolded, reshaped, repurposed,
mm-hmm.
and we can change the trajectory of not only our life, but of other people's life.
Yeah.
And it ripples out, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's nice to be able to say, in my darkest days, I did things that I no longer do.
Yeah. Yeah. You know? That's good.
Or when I catch myself, I stop myself and apologize if necessary.
Yeah.
Because it's hard to change who you are.
Yeah, I think, you know, for me, recovery has been like phases, you know, and the first phase is kind of a self-discovery, a releasing yourself of your own shame and guilt of your past, learning healthy behaviors and patterns in your life. And then as I've found this true for me and a lot of other people, as we continue on the path, we begin to start reprogramming. And so for me, it was going through, you know, codependency, right? For some people, it's adult children of alcoholics. But this kind of third phase almost of recovery,
mm-hmm.
where we go back to acknowledge this programming. And I think what happens is for a lot of us is you're sober, you're going to meetings, you're part of a tribe, you're living a congruent life for the most part, yet you're still fucking miserable. And you're like, what the hell?
Mm-hmm.
And that was my case, and this is the case that I've seen.
I had a guy in my AA meetings that had a really good analogy for that. He says, you've jumped off the sinking ship because it was killing you. You're holding on to your suitcase, and you won't let go of the suitcase, but it's drowning you.
Yeah.
You know, he says, that's part of recovery, is learning how and when to recognize those things that I need to let go of that. I need to let go of
that. How long ago was it that you heard that?
Oh, God. I was 36.
Yeah.
I'm 74.
And you heard that in a group.
In an AA
somebody
meeting,
talked
in an
about
AA
it.
Meeting at the Wesley United Methodist Church where we went to church.
Yeah. And 30 years later. So you never know
what
you might. So raise your hand and share,
like
40
people. Years
later.
That's crazy.
But that was a good analogy because we're holding on to that stuff.
That's exactly it. Yeah. But it takes a while for us to kind of recognize these aren't useful anymore.
Yeah.
Like these things that used to, that protected me in high school or protected me in addiction or protected me in the streets, those things aren't useful anymore. Those patterns, that way of thinking.
That's like that reactivity. It's like when you're on the street, you have to. You don't have a second to pause and consider your next move, you know, because that could get you killed. So you have to be on your feet, be quick thinking. But in recovery, if you are quick thinking on your feet, reacting all the time, you're going to shoot yourself in the foot over and over and over.
Yeah. Right. That's why it's, you know, when wrong, promptly admitted it, right? Like, because we know, they know, hey, you're going to be wrong.
Yeah.
Is pause when agitated, but promptly admit when you're wrong.
It's very important to get the right tribe.
Yeah. And what's it? Restraint of the pen and tongue, right? That saved me a lot of times. So I think, like, for me, that's been the process. I know when I first started working with the mentor that I have today, and he's like, well, how long have you been clean or sober or whatever? How long have you maintained your recovery? And so at the time, I think it was 11 and a half, almost 12 years. He said, that's about the time. That's about the time people come to me when they're in this phase. you know, and that's kind of where his sweet spot is, you know. And so he had these 15 questions that, when did you learn to do this? When did you learn that? When did you learn this? And I would just answer these questions as honestly as possible, and I would sit with him. And so it was like unearthing these patterns of, well, that's where you pick that up. And that's why in your relationship here, you're a needy little bitch, because you, you know, that's somewhere you felt that same kind of sense of, I'm alone and I need someone to fix me. I need something, anything that I need that's outside of myself to fix me or make me better. I'm going to just, by nature, by natural order, I'm going to prioritize that above everything else in my life. I have to learn to self-soothe. I have to learn to calm myself down, or use cognitive behavioral therapy, which is a lot of thinking exercises to go, okay, is this true? This isn't true. And being able to break that. Are you all right?
Yeah.
Are the girls distracting you?
Yeah, thanks for bringing it to everyone's attention.
I can't help it. Our in-studio audience is some rebels without a cause here.
And is your family dog.
It is my family. I mean, do you want to talk a little bit about that? I mean, I know that's like, but I feel like that's been a lot of like where you're in your own recovery.
Yeah, no, because it's definitely been identifying, you know, behaviors and patterns, and like where, like, did I learn it? Like, was it modeled to me, or was it in reaction to something that was happening around? But especially what you were talking about with seeking that external validation, like no matter what form it looks like, you need that external validation. I've found like is a really common thing when people who share that sentiment of, you know, being raised in a house where you feel like nothing's ever good enough, whether it comes from mom or dad or sibling or somebody in the house that you admire and respect. So do you think like that's something, because I know in my family, from talking with family members, that 100% got passed down, you know, and it was never intentional. It was just like whether it's like, I don't know, something I've been telling someone recently is like, you've only been modeled a certain type of behavior. And so you don't want to engage in that behavior, but you don't know what anything else looks like. So you're going to do that behavior. So you need to surround yourself with people who know what other behaviors look like, right? So it's like when you have, you know, since it's Father's Day episode, so you have a father who doesn't know how to be emotionally available, right? Just only knows how to correct. And so then he raises a son who then only knows how to be corrected. He doesn't know how to nurture because his father didn't nurture him. There was no nurture in the home. So he turns around, tries to nurture his kid, but it still comes across as stiff. It still comes across as emotionally unavailable. And so that man doesn't know how to then turn around and father his child.
Me, it sounds like me. Shit. My son's sitting over there. I'm like, God damn, I fucked that up.
Being the dad's hard, let me tell you.
Yeah. No, absolutely.
You said that really well. I could understand exactly what you were saying, because it fit. You know, same mold, different factory, same mold.
Yeah. And I'm thinking also as like, you know, a lot of these things that may start out as defects of character, you know, they also become, they're also assets.
They can serve you very well.
Right. Yeah. I think like one of the reasons why I think I've been able to be independent, self-employed for so long is because I have that work ethic, because I get up and I remember even young making music, and music was my priority. That's what I was mainly doing. You know, we had one kid and it was just like, but I would never feel good to get into the studio at the end of the day, or whenever it was, if my bills weren't paid. You know what I mean? Like, if I didn't have my shit together, it was really hard to feel free to write creatively.
Yeah.
You know, so I always had that kind of sense, and I think that's what's made me a good freelancer. I wouldn't say I'm an entrepreneur, but I would say it's made me good at being independent. Yeah. Because I have whatever that regulator is in me to go, you got to push a little harder today. You got to get some things in the done column, you know?
But yeah. I love that you bring up work ethic, because that's one of those things that most often is only thought of as an asset, you know, but in my experience and what I've seen, you know, because I learned it from it being modeled, is that it is also a defect, you know? It's you know, like workaholic, right? It's like, so when I was growing up, like I watched my parents get hit really hard by the recession, right? And so I, you know, growing, when I was little, you know, we like, you know, big family of six, we'd go out to eat all the time and, you know, we'd go on family vacations and then the recession hit and all of a sudden it's like, you know, I'm like literally watching my mom go chase down the utilities people after shutting off our utilities with a check, like, please turn it back on. And so with that, my dad was working all the time because it was, but the options were, you know, work all the time, no food on the table, you know, it's like, okay, so he wasn't around. And so while it's like, that was like an act of love, right? He had to do that for us to have food on the table. It still like left that impact of like not having my dad around.
Yeah. Christian had that too. I worked two jobs for a long time.
Yeah.
I'd get off work and go to work for myself.
Well, it's kind of the conundrum of fatherhood. I think that only fathers can really understand is like, you're...
Well, I had a stay-at-home mom for my kids, and we both agreed on that, and I was 100% okay with that. You know, when you guys got older, she wanted to go to work. It's like, okay, the kids are older, go to work. But it was having the mom at home with the kids, I thought, was really important when the kids were in those first 5, 6, 7, 8 years before they really got to where you could trust them.
Yeah.
But it meant me going to work at 6 o'clock in the morning, coming home at 4, taking off that uniform, putting on my street clothes, and going to work for myself, doing the same thing I did when I was...
Yeah,
first 8 hours.
That's the exact same situation I was raised
when you
in.
Said that it was just, but that's, and you've done it because I used to watch you do 14, 16-hour days.
Yeah,
it's just what dads do.
Yeah, and that's the conundrum. It's like you want to be available,
but you can't because you got to work.
But you also have to, and not every father approaches fatherhood like that. I would say like, I would call myself like old school, right? Like being a provider. And I remember the first time that string ever started getting pulled on was when I was in treatment. And they gave us this card of all these other addictions. And one of them was a performance addict. And I'd never, 33 years old, I'd never heard of what's a performance addict.
Is that like a scientific way to talk about a praise kink? Like
a praise kink? No, but now I'll be Googling praise kinks. That might be something that could be fun.
Most High After Dark.
Most High After Dark. Oh yeah, catch us on the Patreon. So performance addict it's that other side of workaholism. It's like I have no worth and value if I cannot
perform.
If I don't provide value to you in some sort of way, I inherently have no value. That's different from like commerce and marketplace, which is like I have something of value. Mm-hmm.
Okay, I was going to say, how is it different?
Because you attach your self-worth to that. And that's what I think a lot of men and people, I think people in general do.
Guys, what do you do?
Yeah.
You know, what do you do? Oh, I'm a this.
Yeah.
What do you do? I'm a that.
It's different. I think, like, for me, the beginning of unraveling that, and, you know, I feel like I've grown a lot in that way, it ends up freeing me to do a better job now. Because now I want to do a good job because I care, right? And I can look at something and go, we can do better. That's very different from going, if this thing doesn't get received by everyone or if it doesn't go well, then I myself am not a good person. That was the connection that I think I was making, right?
It's a daily... It's a frequent thing I have to remind myself is that my value as a person has nothing to do with my productivity. Because my productivity and my accomplishments and my achievements, because like I got to do better than I did yesterday. I got to do better than I did yesterday. But it's like, you know what? I don't feel as good as I did yesterday, you know, but I'm still a human being who is worthy of breathing and being loved by people, even if I'm having an off day, even if I'm moving at a slower pace.
Yeah.
And I'm not a man and relate to this intimately.
No, I'm glad.
Working. It's, you know, you push the wheel. What do you do every day? I push the wheel.
Yeah.
Remember the game we used to play? Hi, my name is Joe.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I was doing that to the interns the other day, and they were like, what the hell are you doing?
Hi, my name is Joe.
Hi, my name is Joe, and I work at the button.
I got a wife, three kids, and I work in a button factory. The other day, Joe came to me and said, Christian, are you busy?
And I said, no. Then push the button,
With your right hand.
Yeah.
And then he does it again in the left hand. And then the right knee, then the left knee, and then your butt. And before you know it, you're wiggling all around, and everybody's laughing. It's a fun game.
Yeah. But it's a little bit like what it is to...
To work in a job where...
Yeah.
Because have you ever worked at it? Well, you've worked for yourself for a long time, but all my jobs, it always ended up to where if you did a really good job, then they'd give you more work to do and expect you to do it with the same resources that you did a really good job with.
Yeah, if you do a really good job at work, they reward you by giving you more work.
Yeah, and I used to go and say, okay, this is my list of priorities that you've given me, and I don't have enough hours in the day to do these. You tell me which ones you want me to sideline. You prioritize these for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I'll get them done, but I can't do all that.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and they say, well, you should be able to work 9, 10, 12 hours a day. And it's like, I was a manager, so they expect you to work.
Right.
I said, no, if I can't do my job in 8 hours, get somebody else.
Mm. Yeah.
Mm. So.
All right. Is there anything we're not? I think we've touched on some really good.
Yeah, touched on some good.
Good
definitely
stuff.
But, you know, with breaking generational curses, that's like that's a phrase I grew up with, so I always like associated that with, you know, certain denominations.
Yeah.
And then in recovery, I think that's been like a common phrase. Yeah. And I don't know if that's just because we're in the Bible Belt, but I really feel like, you know, it's just such an important thing to talk about. And like I see it, you know, talked about online more often than I used to, you know, especially with people normalizing therapy and that being a good tool to help, you know, like, identify those behaviors, identify learned behaviors and all that sort of stuff. So, I mean, I know like we talked about like various like recovery, like 12-step recovery and, you know, support meetings and stuff. But what have been some other tools you think that have been beneficial in breaking these patterns?
In my recovery in 1985, there was no rehab. You couldn't afford to go to rehab. There probably was rehab, but it wasn't for us working Joe's. So mine was, you know, I did my 3 or 4 meetings a week and got busy with the church and busy with the family and, you know, but there wasn't a safety net. So it was good that I got into a meeting with some really good old timers that were in there that had wise remarks like the suitcase.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I always felt weird about like the religious connotation of generational curses. Like it was kind of spooky and weird.
Mm-hmm.
So when I found out about ACEs, when I found out about this crow's funeral, and I'm like, oh no, this is actually science.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like the scripture is referencing something that's true. It just wasn't using the same terminology. But when you look at it from a scientific way, you can see, no, this is a thing. Like we pass these things down on. And, you know, I think community is huge. You know, I think marrying up helped me a lot, you know. That was probably a good accidentally just falling in love with the right person, you know. I think that definitely was a bonus for me because having somebody who was not like me in the I have this hole inside of me that I can never fill, right? Somebody who is just a human, you know. I think that really... It was instrumental, you know. Is that the dog?
Eli does not like this fake tree.
He don't like shout out to Leslie over there. I think that was very helpful. And I think self-acceptance, I think, is key. Like, I think what people do is you become aware of a pattern, whether it be thinking or behavioral, and then you immediately want to take action on that. And there's another A there, which is acceptance. So becoming aware of a thinking pattern or a behavioral pattern or some aspect of your life that no longer serves you, and then accepting it, acknowledging it and accepting that it exists, and really accepting it to go, okay, this is who I am. I am kind of a rough around the edges, not thinking about other people. I am selfish and self-centered, and I am driven by 100 forms of fear. And really acknowledging that, not so that I could not use, but that this is who I am. And then taking the action to correct that. I think that's a key thing for me. That, and I missed that acceptance portion for a long time. Mm-hmm. And so I was sober and miserable for a really long time, which is the worst to be.
You know,
it can't go to the drugs because you just know that's not going to work, mm-hmm. right? So I think once I learned that it was okay to not be perfect. It was okay to be like to have crazy thoughts and to not be constantly emotionally regulated all the time.
Yeah.
And then once I accepted that as who I was, that was when I allowed the space for it to change.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, you know, after your mom left and it was just you and me and your sister, I was a broken guy. That the only thing I knew I was supposed to do was finish raising two kids. I didn't know how to do it. I was the guy that was always off working. This was not my wheelhouse. And I didn't do a great job, but I was steady Eddie. So, and it was always food on the table. Dinner was never missed dinner.
Yeah.
And but as you guys got older and I got more time to work on me, I started doing a lot of things, a lot of self-help stuff that really helped me. And the thing that where you were just talking about it, about how do you change? You can't change what you don't know needs to be changed. So mm-hmm. first you have to recognize that this is causing me problems in my life. You know, just to pick a thing. I got to stop doing that. Every time I do that, it makes it worse. So, okay, I've accepted that I do that. But how do you change it?
Yeah.
So you need it. The next element is time. So I want to change that. So what happens is you do it, you catch yourself, and you do it, and you catch yourself, and you do it, and you catch yourself. And the time between doing it and catching yourself continually gets smaller to the point where now you can catch yourself just before you do it or maybe right after.
Yeah.
And if you do that long enough, that will fall off the wayside. But without those two elements, without the third one is the desire to make the change. You have to identify it. You have to desire to make the change. Then you have to give yourself enough time to make that change. Because we're human. It's not happening overnight.
Time.
And when you're dealing with something that you've been in, it's been in your life since you were five, that takes a long time to get rid of.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, but throwing a tantrum at 50 doesn't work.
Time takes time.
That's exactly what I was thinking.
Yeah, time takes time. That's Costa's dad said that on a show like 5 years ago or something. And now it's like a saying that we're all, time takes time.
Yeah.
He's a Puerto Rican guy. Time takes time, Costa. All right. I think we've done it. I think we did an episode.
We did do an episode.
Yeah, I think we did. And I want to, our guest next week is going to be interesting.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah. If this didn't wet your whistle, next week, Brian Watson will be in studio. And he's got a list of topics that he wants to talk about. It's pretty interesting. The modern man's relationship with God, is it lost or evolving?
Okay.
Do you need religion? Breaking generational curses. All right. Sorry, dude. We already did that one. Signs from the universe. Psychological coincidences. I like this one. Meditation in the hood. How to find stillness in chaos.
Okay.
Yeah. So I met him a few times. He's a good friend of Joseph from Choice Recovery. And so I'm interested to have him. So he'll be on next week. I want to thank you, Dad, Eric, for being on the show.
Oh, I'm happy to do it.
Yeah, speaking openly and honestly. Yes. Round of applause. And I want to send a shout out to, you know, every guy out there who's trying to be a father, you know. And, you know.
Hey, fatherhood's hard. And we said that a lot. But you know what? It's absolutely worth it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, because look what I ended up with. I ended up with this huge tribe that's all related to me.
Yeah.
You know, that. Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. It's beautiful.
Yeah.
Yeah. And thank you to the donor supporters who make this show possible. Thank you to the crew running the behind the scenes. Thank you to Sarah for showing up every Friday. Yes.
Glad to be here.
We're going to have to start doing before and after photos, though, because people need to know the transformation that happens.
What, when I get here from work?
From when you get here from work. To
the go from dyke to dyke 2.0. Happy Pride.
This has been an episode of The Most High Show. Peace.
Good job.
That was so good.
That was really good. Yeah,
I was like, you said next week. I was like, who's on the calendar? You had just texted me about it.
Had I?
Yeah, because you
told me. Like, who's Brian?
Yeah, and I was like, I don't know, but here's my mutual. Let's ask
one of them. You can probably grab anybody in my age group, and even older. It's the volume of life history.
Yeah. Well, we did it like.